Hello, my name is Veronika Kasova. I live in Edinburgh and I just graduated with a Master's in Psychology of Mental Health. Marion recommended me the Clinical Psychologist Collective when I was networking on LinkedIn, and I must say I love it. It is one of a kind. It's like a window into the lives of people on the path of becoming a psychologist. The stories are unique, honest, and filled with a kind of intangible wisdom only personal storytelling can uncover. A common thread in the stories I valued most was to be compassionate not only with others, but with myself too. Also, not fixating on becoming a psychologist, but enjoying life, growth, and the final results will come as a byproduct. Marianne, thank you for taking the time to collate all the stories. The book is a true gem, and I think every aspiring psychologist should have a copy on their shelf. Thank you.
If you're looking to become a psychologist, then let this be your guide. With this podcast at your side, you'll be on your way to being qualified. It's the Aspiring Psychologist Podcast. Dr. Marianne Trent.
Hi, welcome along to the Aspiring Psychologist podcast. Thank you for listening as ever, and thank you for all of your super kind comments. They're really gratefully received. I'd really love any audio testimonials for the podcast itself or any of the books. Just so that I know that you're really enjoying what you're listening to. And I'd really love to have any audio testimonials you might be willing to leave me for the podcast itself. For more information on how to do that, go to www.goodthinkingpsychology.co.uk/podcast, or the link will be there in the show notes for you too. This is all about collaboration, and another great piece of collaboration is when we work as part of multidisciplinary teams, also called MDTs. And being part of an MDT and having had MDT experience is something which is really useful for any aspiring psychologist, and it's something that often crops up for assistant psychologist interviews. I learned my trade in working in multidisciplinary teams when I was at St Andrew's Healthcare. That was the first MDT team that I had been part of, and I was so fortunate that I'd been around such highly skilled and competent, caring, kind team members, and I learned a great deal from them, and they were kind and patient towards me as I developed my stripes as an aspiring psychologist too. So when I was thinking about reaching out to have a psychiatrist on the podcast, my first thoughts were of a psychiatrist that I had worked with as an aspiring psychologist. And so I was brave and I reached out and asked him if he would be willing to come along and record an episode for us. And he was so kind and gracious and said that he would love to. So I am thrilled to introduce you to someone I knew as Doxa. And since I have moved on to Pastures New, he has gone on to become a professor. So you're going to be listening to me chatting with Professor Graham Yulston, who is a consultant psychiatrist. And today's episode is all about working with MDTs, but also about practical ways to manage risk as well, which is something that psychiatrists are really good at and something that I learned a lot from my time working at St Andrews. I hope you find this episode really useful. And as ever, we welcome any comments, any questions. You can watch this on YouTube, but it is audio only, so you'll just have lots of nice pictures to look at if you're watching on YouTube. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please do rate and review. It'd be gratefully received. So yeah, hope you find this episode useful. So welcome along. I just want to say hi and welcome our guest, Professor Graham Yorston. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Hi, yes, I'm Graham Yorston. I am a forensic neuropsychiatrist. So I've had a kind of wide range of experience in different areas of psychiatry, worked in different hospitals around the country, in Scotland and England, and different levels of security. So from high secure, medium secure, low secure, and currently working in a rehab setting in Northampton.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. Our paths first crossed when I was an assistant psychologist. So when I was looking at how to thicken the dialogue of psychiatry and psychology, you were the first person I thought of. But I'm a little bit daunted to have you here.
I can't imagine why you'd be daunted. No, I think, you know, assistant psychologists do form a really important part of MDTs. And I think it is difficult because, you know, particularly if you're a brand new assistant psychologist, you're quite young and everybody else in the team is usually a bit older and they may have years and years of experience, but there's absolutely nothing to be daunted by. You know, most people in MDTs are very nice and very welcoming.
They certainly are. And I always felt very welcome in the teams when I worked with you. So thank you. I do remember you didn't really like my hair accessories at the time. And you had a very valid point. Don't even remember, I had some sort of crazy chopsticks in my hair. And you were like, someone could easily poke you in the eye with those. And I was like, yes, you may be right.
Gosh, I think the Alzheimer's must be catching up with me. I don't actually remember that. No, you mentioned it. I mean, it's the kind of important issue of kind of risk awareness that somebody right at the start of their career just may not think about, things like that that could be used as a potential weapon in a secure unit where people have a history of serious violence.
Absolutely. I did give it back to you, though. I did say, well, they could whip the pen out of your pocket as well, Dr. Yorston. And you were like, yeah, but then I'd know they'd done that. You wouldn't know if they were behind you. And I was like, all right, you're totally right. I never wore them again to work, by the way.
Very sensible. I did take a pen in, and you're absolutely right. So pens are a potential weapon, and in some of the most acute wards in high secure hospitals, you have to leave your pens in store, and you are only allowed to use those little tiny stubby pens that that kind of 3 or 4 inches long,
like you steal from Asda, not Asda, Argos.
That's the ones.
we don't condone stealing here.
No, they've
switched them to pencils now, you know.
You can still hurt someone seriously with a pencil, and you know, particularly if it's a really sharp pencil, you can do a lot of damage. And certainly in one of the hospitals that I worked at, it was damage to people's eyes that were the kind of preferred, that doesn't sound quite the right word, but it was a not uncommon form of attack was to stab people in the eye with a pen or a pencil.
So you were absolutely right to highlight the risk of me wearing chopsticks to work. So thank you for that. But it's an important area to consider, isn't it? When we're working with risk, especially not even when we're working in forensic services, you know, any setting we're working in, even someone we think we know really well could potentially be risky.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point to get across. If you're working in a high secure hospital, then you're going to get a lot of induction about risk. And you're going to be well aware that you're dealing with people who could pose a risk to you. But if you're working in an outpatient setting or an acute psychiatry inpatient setting, then that's the first point of contact that people will have with mental health services. So some of those people who do eventually end up in high secure hospital have started in those services. So they might have all those kind of aggressive tendencies. They just haven't been... no one knows about them yet. So you have to at least be aware of the potential for aggression and make sure that you're safe, make sure that you can get out of an interview room and not put yourself at risk in any way.
Absolutely. I still remember setting up the room quite carefully. I vividly remember you dragging chairs around to make sure that you were going to be able to get out of rooms and the staff were if we needed to, and that there were enough escorts or people trained in restraint when we were all trained in restraint, weren't we? But to be able to, have the best possible outcome from any any situation. It's about thinking in advance, isn't it? And planning for the worst, preparing for the worst, and hoping it won't happen.
Definitely, yes. And I think you've got to stay in control if you are in a hospital or any kind of healthcare setting of getting the room positioned before the person comes in. Always looks a bit strange if you're moving furniture around once they're in. But, you know, get yourself so that you are closest to the door.
And I have done that time and time again all throughout my career. Even in children's services, I was always closest to the door, because I've learned from you and from our late colleague, Dr. Wood, how to ensure that your safety and the patient's safety is optimised.
Yeah, these are very important lessons. I'm glad that I'm surprised that I was the first person to tell you about that. But it is, those are important lessons that, you know, get into a good habit early in your career and always stick with it. It'll just become second nature then. You won't think about it.
Definitely. And one of my top tips that I learned was pop your diary on your chair when you go and get the patient so they can't sit in your chair. And it's always quite interesting when they try to, or they give you your diary back and then you have to say, actually, I'm going to sit there. It's a test of kind of social norms as well.
That sounds an interesting one. I don't think you learned that one from me, because that's a really good tip, actually. I have to remember that one myself.
I have useful strategies as well. You also taught me something that you may not know that you taught me, but I use every day. So I often used to do the notes in our ward round sessions, but sometimes you would do it. And you were doing something on the computer and I thought, how did he do that? And you introduced me to using the delete button to delete text that you've already typed, just to hold your finger on it. Whereas before I met you, I was backspacing every single thing. So every time I do that, I do think of you.
Good heavens, me teaching someone IT, that sounds highly improbable, but I'll take your word for it.
You have to tell your children and they'll be delighted.
Yeah, back in the day, I was a relatively new adopter of information technology, but I feel like a dinosaur nowadays because it's all moving way too fast for me.
Well, you were an influencer when it came to me and the delete key, so thank you. Have you learned anything along your career from a random source that's been really useful, or something that you can think of that you think, oh, well, that was really important for me, or I use that all the time, and you wouldn't necessarily have known that you were planning to learn it at the time?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, training as a doctor is very much an apprenticeship. So, you know, obviously a lot of your facts, your knowledge, it comes from books and papers and things, but actually how to deal with people, how to approach people, how to interact with team members is very much about seeing, you know, being in teams, observing how those teams interact, and then going, yeah, I like the way this person is running, you know, his or her team. And that's how I would want to be. And equally, seeing people doing it not so well and being a little bit too formal or whatever it might be, and thinking, yeah, I don't want to do it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And how to position yourself in teams can be so important, can't it? Definitely.
I think this is one of the key issues for assistant psychologists, because you're coming into a team. You probably don't know people very well. The team may be very established and have been, you know, going along for years, are good relationships. There might be people with years and years of clinical experience. And, you know, on your first day, you go into this ward round and see the sea of faces that you don't know. How do you fit into that team? What do you do? Do you be a big personality and kind of, you know, introduce yourself at full volume, or do you kind of just sit in the back row and be very meek and mild and hardly say a thing? And it's very difficult, I think, to break into that team and to be aware that that's, you know, that requires effort and work and thinking about, I think, is important. I think the more that you make a conscious effort to think about, well, how am I going to do this? You know, the better it's likely to be, and every team's going to be different. So, as I say, you know, I've worked in in a huge number of different environments, and the extent to which the medical model is dominant varies between teams, and therefore the extent to which psychological input into those teams is going to be absolutely integral or slightly peripheral is also going to vary. And I would say, you know, as a new AP joining a team, listen, observe relatively quietly. You don't want to be completely anonymous, but you know, don't go in with a big personality and big opinions straight off, because like people are just going to look at you and think, who is this person? So, you know, observe, be helpful to the team. So it's one of the things I've always done is occasionally make coffee, so that absolutely everybody in the team is part of that rota. No one is above going and making coffee for everybody else, and that helps bonding. So again, depending on how the kind of MDT meetings are organised, usually patients will be brought into those meetings, and I think it works really well if right from the beginning, as an assistant psychologist, you say, would you like me to go and get the patient, rather than relying on one person to do that. And also, I think understanding what the model of the psychology input to the team is it a totally integrated approach? Are you there every week for every MDT meeting or ward round, every CPA? Are you there on that ward and it's your ward, or is it more of a kind of referral model? And if it's a referral model and you're just going to occasional ones, then that's fine to then ask for referrals. But if you're in part of an integrated team, then there's nothing worse than if somebody in the team is saying it would be really helpful to have a psychology opinion on this, to then say, all right, great, thank you. Can you do a referral, please? It is probably the thing that gets me not irritated, it's not as strong as that, but just frustrated more than anything else.
Yeah, I think it's tricky. Certainly in community services where I've worked, you kind of can't launch in straight away. But when you're on an inpatient ward and you're all there anyway, you know, it feels like you can come to the fore a little bit more quickly, you know, and support on the ground without additional forms.
That's it. Yeah, I mean, so being aware of, everybody is time pressured. I'm not saying that any one professional group is less time pressured than any other, but particularly for nurses and doctors, you're constantly reprioritizing. And that is something that happens less, I think, in psychology. You're often able, you have a luxury of being able to kind of work through a kind of a to-do list without constantly having to put things, I've got to move this one forward and that one back. At least that's my impression. Tell me if I'm completely wrong on that, but that's my impression. And so the kind of the urgency of things sometimes feels more from people from kind of nursing and medical backgrounds. And just being aware of that really, I think, is important.
Yeah, I think even since when I was working alongside you, the expectations on unqualified psychologists has gone through the roof. So I didn't hold my own caseload when I was working with you. I was very much to support the psychologist and the psychology functions, but also the MDT. So, you know, I might have done the odd bit of neuropsych here and there. I was doing, the monitoring and the recording of all of the sexually inappropriate behaviours and the aggression and reporting on those for the ward rounds and things. But I didn't hold my own caseload, whereas actually what's happened in the time since I was an aspiring psychologist is that people are being encouraged to hold their own caseloads as well. And people are working, you know, sometimes even as much as, you know, 80, 90% of their whole time equivalent hours are face-to-face client times. And that's a big pressure. It's a big change. And the level of even the level of risk and responsibility that aspiring psychologists are being asked to hold these times, in these times, I grew into that responsibility. And we're asking a lot more, a lot sooner, I think, which gives you less room for a little bit of playfulness and less room to, you know, to make those mistakes and to learn by watching other people do it, because there's more pressure on you. You know, like you said, it's nice to come in and grow into a role, but actually a lot of aspiring psychologists are finding that they're kind of being, you know, farmed out and put on the production line and expected to perform almost from day one, and it's very difficult.
Okay, that really does sound like being thrown in at the deep end. And my sense is that that is how I learned as a doctor, and I think most other people, you know, learn that. The old kind of maxim of see one, do one, teach one. You see some procedure once, you then expected to be able to do it yourself, and then once you've done one, you're expected to teach everybody else how to do it. And I don't think that's right, but your pace of learning is much more than if you start off very cautiously and spend a lot of time observing. You're going to learn an awful lot more from doing than you are from watching someone else do. So, I mean, it's interesting that you're saying that. I perhaps hadn't realized that there'd been that change. So it's tough, but it will definitely, you know, help people decide more quickly if they're in the right career and if it suits them.
And there is that, isn't there? There is burnout in our profession as a mental health professional, and especially during the pandemic, you know, because there wasn't any working from home when there's patients to go in and support who are living in inpatient units. It's very difficult. How's your experience of burnout been in the profession, and how to support and nurture members of the team to try to reduce burnout?
Yeah, I think it is very important, and it has been very, very tough. I mean, my current job, as I say, is a rehab unit, and we're trying to all the time help people become reintegrated into the community. And to then try and do that when they were literally not allowed outside the hospital, there was the national guidelines and then the local public health guidelines that said, actually, you're a hospital, therefore your patients aren't allowed out. And that was for months on end. And it was very tough for the patients. Absolutely amazingly well in coping with that. But it was also tough on staff, because it meant that they were having to be constantly thinking of new things to do to stop people getting bored and to try and recreate some of the things that they would be doing if they were in the community. So we had about 1,000,001 barbecues and things, just trying to keep fresh was a real challenge. But I think burnout generally is an important issue. People do talk about it, but often slightly reluctant to talk about their own problems. I've certainly had problems in my own career at times where things got very difficult, and you need to be able to talk to someone. If you feel things building up, if you're not enjoying your work, if you kind of wake up in the morning and just think, oh God, I don't want to go in, I can't face it, then that's a problem and you need to talk about that. And there's usually resolutions to these things. And it may be that, a change of scene, a change of team. I think we're both lucky that we've worked with great teams and great team members, but sometimes teams don't function very well. And if you're in one of these, let's call it a toxic team, they do exist. It's horrible. And sometimes the only thing you can do is get out of that as quickly as possible, or at least limit your kind of exposure to the toxicity. So absolutely talking to your supervisor and being kind of open and honest about things. Honesty is always the best policy. You know, people worry, oh, if I kind of worry or sound like I'm moaning, then I might not get a good reference. But it's far better to be honest, I think, and deal with problems. You know, you can get bullying, you can get inappropriate attention, all sorts of issues can arise. And you have to deal with it. I think you have to deal with it.
Yeah, I love that idea actually about thinking about maybe it's not me, you know, maybe I'm okay. Maybe the problem is the environment here. Maybe this is a toxic team. And people often say to me, well, I'm a bit worried about just having like a 6 month post or a 4 month post on my CV and how that looks. And it's like, actually, no, you're the golden goose. You have to look after you. And if this isn't a good fit for you, it's okay to say no. It's okay to say, actually, I'm going elsewhere because this is not okay for me. This is not how I, you know, like your values of how to treat people. This is not how I think it's okay to treat people. And I'm going to vote with my feet. You know, I'm going to use my voice. And if saying no is not making a difference, you can be empowered and you can make different choices to go elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is tricky. I think in some ways it's slightly easier towards the end of your career or once you've had a few years under your belt because you've got some experience to draw on. At the start of your career, it's very hard to say, actually, this just is not working for me. But, you know, trust yourself and, follow your instincts is what I would say. And if it just feels horrible when you go to work, that is not normal, it's not right, and you shouldn't put up with it.
Absolutely. I'll have to say working with you was not a toxic environment. I really, really enjoyed it. And leaving St Andrews was really difficult for me, from a really supportive, really cohesive, really big and broad team, to then going somewhere very much smaller in the NHS where I was the only assistant and there was one qualified forensic psychologist. It couldn't have been, you know, tiny little healthcare building, couldn't have been more different. And I really mourned for all of you when I left. You know, it's still, it's important to build different portfolios of your work across your career. But it's really difficult, hard to replicate what you guys were offering in terms of experience and nurturance as well, and really good staff parties.
I'm glad you enjoyed those. Yeah, no, St Andrews, I would say, at the time you were there, most of the time that I was there was a fantastic place to work. And I know that it, you know, it helped many psychologists go on to bigger and better things. It was a great place to do research and just make those kind of take those first footsteps towards, you know, just, you know, having a bit more on your CV than just clinical work. Getting involved in research is so important. My current post at St Matthew's Healthcare, that's one of the things that I've been trying to do is get and encourage assistant psychologists to be involved in very simple little research projects. I mean, it doesn't have to be some massive international collaboration study, just, you know, case report, getting that done as a poster, kind of writing up an audit, all those kind of things. Just gives you a bit more on your CV. It also, yeah, helps build relationships. And I'm a great believer in research, and the advantages really that research brings to helping you think about anything really. Obviously, if you're writing a paper, it will be about that particular topic, but it's how you approach any topic in your career is important, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, research is so important. It's one of the key aspects for aspiring psychologists. And it's, you know, you get separate points on your forms for research. So I did my first piece of published research was at St Andrews. And if Dr. Yorston, as you were at the time, you're now a professor, had asked me to get involved, I'd have snapped your hand off. I really would.
I can't believe I didn't ask you. I'm always asking, but
I'd have written it up for you. But this is one of the advantages, you know, you can approach people and say, do you need any help with writing up this research? Because then you get your name on a paper, which is amazing, amazing. And research is useful for the now. But what leads us on quite nicely to the next area of conversation is that it's really useful to reflect upon as well and to help us learn about what went before us and what people's previous assumptions were about mental health. And this is really a specialist area of interest for you as well. Do you want to tell us a little bit about why and what I'm talking about?
Yes, that's a very nice lead-in. Thank you very much. Yeah, so I've always been interested in the history of psychiatry. I think my very first paper actually was a history of psychiatry paper. And I just always believed that it's important to have a full understanding of of what our ideas about mental health problems and diagnoses are now. We have to understand how those ideas have evolved over time. And for some disorders, it goes right back to ancient Greece and ancient Egypt and early China and India. So they're very, very long roots to some of the mental disorders. Others are very modern. And unless you have some understanding about that, it's very difficult, I think, to fully grasp the importance of of diagnoses and why words are important. So as I say, I've been doing interest in that all my life. Just in the last 6 months, I have started a YouTube channel on the history of mental health. If I'm honest, I probably wouldn't have done it if it hadn't been for the help of my son doing all the technical stuff. But we've so far put out, I think it's nine videos on a kind of wide range of history of mental health topics. And they're quite unusual. I think looking at other videos out there, that we're definitely trying to aim for them being quite academic. So there's lots of kind of references to papers and in the about section of the videos, I do include a kind of academic reference list. So they are meant to be understandable to the general public, but to be of particular interest, I think, to people working in mental health.
Well, I've watched two of them so far, and honestly, I find them really interesting. I think it's really useful to have the theory behind it, but from an expert as well, from someone that gets it in the modern context and can portray it in a really relatable way. It's really unique.
Yeah, I think they're quite good. and in terms of kind of viewing figures, it's interesting that, it's building. And also just looking at some of the other videos out there on very similar ranges of topics, some of them you kind of realize that this person has really just read out a Wikipedia entry almost word for word, and that's okay, and that's often where I start. If it's a topic I don't know much about, that's usually my starting point, but I will definitely try and add a bit more context. And what I will always try and do is talk about how ideas have changed over time. And that's particularly interesting, I think, for more recent history. So I've done a couple of videos on, one in particular, I think, Rosemary Kennedy, the sister of President Kennedy. She had probably a kind of mild learning disability, might even not have been below the kind of diagnostic threshold if she was formally tested. But at the time, there was huge stigma associated with that, and some terrible old-fashioned phrases that we, it's really hard to speak them out loud nowadays. Feeble-mindedness, morons, all this kind of terminology was in the medical and psychological literature. There were people writing papers about this and suggesting that they should be compulsorily sterilized. And in the US, there were 60,000 people were sterilized because they were thought to be unfit for breeding. And obviously that went to its furthest extreme in Germany, where people with mental illness, and learning disability were killed, were murdered. Thousands of them, 300,000. So it's important to know. So that's just about within living memory, 1930s, obviously the war, period, that there are fewer and fewer people around that actually remember that. But the kind of folk memory, if you like, of ideas and stigma and lives on. And even within my career, I can see changes in the way mentally ill people have been regarded, the way psychiatry is viewed by other members of the medical profession. And if I'm honest, I probably would have shared some of those ideas at medical school. It's like, who wants to be a psychiatrist? You know, that's terrible. You know, he'd never do anything very much. He'd never cure anyone. Would have been the kind of rhetoric back in the 1980s. And it's been, you know, over the last 30, 40 years, there has been a gradual move, a gradual acceptance that, that mental illness isn't something to be ashamed of. And I think, you know, particularly in maybe in the last 10 years, we're gradually moving towards this greater acceptance, but there's still a long way to go. There's still a lot of those ideas that were still there, you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s. They're still there. They still affect people's thinking.
Thank you. That's so interesting. And I love the breadth and the depth of your experience, which I think is what your competition do not have, because, you know, you've earned your stripes. Absolutely. And there's something to be said about aspiring psychologists learning that breadth and that depth as well, isn't it? And learning about the importance of the theory.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that a lot of assistant psychologists talk about is diagnosis, and obviously that's not necessarily a word that is the right word for psychology, but it is the way doctors work and have done, you know, for probably 2,000 years. So you've got to at least understand what a diagnosis is. And sometimes I get asked questions like, "What is the official diagnosis?" And that one always prompts a little bit of discussion, and from me, as I say, well, you know, a diagnosis is just an opinion, and even if we say, well, they fit the criteria of DSM or ICD-10, those are just our current ideas on what the criteria should be, and those have changed over time. They've changed, you know, over the last 50 years, and certainly over longer periods of history. So a formulation actually is a more valid, individualized way of thinking about a person, but everyone's always interested in diagnoses. So you have to fit your, or be willing to at least accommodate a diagnosis in formulations.
Yeah, I mean, diagnosis is really useful because it, you know, like you said, it gives us an understanding of how best to understand someone's difficulties and what might be a robust evidence-based treatment plan, but it doesn't define somebody.
No, and that's the big downside, obviously, of diagnoses, it puts people into boxes, and we're dealing with individuals, and so whilst I would always have a diagnosis for a patient, you know, I also make sure that I have a lot of information on their early development, their premorbid personality, so that, you know, you're saying, well, this is the diagnosis, but then this is the individual that with this diagnosis and how it has affected them.
Yeah, I think it's really useful to discuss with people as well what their diagnosis means and how they feel about it. So I work a lot with developmental trauma, I should say people who have had developmental trauma experiences. And a lot of them are diagnosed with borderline personality disorder or emotionally unstable personality disorder. And they really aren't okay with that because they've already been through awful, awful things, you know, pretty much from the point that they were conceived. So then to be labelled with EUPD feels like a real kick in the guts. And so it's a useful conversation to have.
Absolutely, yeah. So I always discuss diagnosis with patients, whether they remember it, whether they want to remember it is another thing entirely. But for something as incendiary as EUPD is such an important diagnosis. But also, you know, helping patients understand that, you know, if what that actually says to other people who will be reading that diagnosis. And sadly, it's, you know, it's not going to, you know, people are going to think, oh, right, difficult patient. And I think it's useful for patients to know that diagnoses are going to evoke emotional responses in other healthcare professionals.
Definitely. I have loved speaking with you today, and I honestly feel like I could speak to you all day, but we tried to keep these episodes at about 30 minutes, so we're going to need to draw it to a close. Have you got any final points or kind of questions or observations that you want to make?
Yeah, no, just really, you know, work hard at becoming part of the team, as I say, make the coffee, go and get the patients.
But you will also sometimes make the coffee, you know, not being
absolutely
elitist.
No, definitely not. So, you know, if there's any psychiatrists listening to this, then do not expect people to make coffee for you. Be willing to go and make it. So it's although usually the psychiatrist is the unelected leader of the team, there's no real reason for that. There's no management responsibility that says, oh, the doctor has to be in charge, but that's just the way most teams work. Not every team, but the way most teams work. And just being aware of that and working with it, and with the being aware of the kind of the history of how psychiatry, psychology and other professions have developed and all work together.
I love it. It's been such an interesting episode and been a pleasure to speak to you. How can people get connected with you? Where are you at with your YouTube channel?
YouTube search, putting Professor Graham Yorston or History of Mental Health, that will lead to my videos. And that's probably the easiest way to get hold of me. I think my son's even opened a TikTok one for me, but I don't really know what's on that yet. I don't really understand TikTok, but I'm not doing any dancing. Safe with that one. So that's probably the easiest place to see me.
Lovely. Let's have a practice. What should people do when they get to your channel?
Oh, yes. They should. Now, what is it called again? Subscribe. Yeah, so subscribe.
And like.
And like. And comment. And... So comments is important. One of the things you do have to be aware of, though, is you have to develop a thick skin. So there's overwhelmingly positive comments so far, but by gum, there's a few absolutely horrible ones. So you have to learn to kind of not focus on those, which is, you know, it's important in life to be able to do that. So like, subscribe and click on the notification so that when the new ones come out, it goes, you somehow know about it miraculously by the wonder of technology.
I love that, honestly. Do it, and do it for this channel as well, because this one's good too. It's been an absolute pleasure to reconnect with you, and wishing you all the best with your YouTube channel and beyond, and book writing and all of those good things that are going to be coming imminently. Thank you so much for joining me.
And thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Hello, my name is Veronika Kasova. I live in Edinburgh, and I just graduated with a Master's in Psychology of Mental Health. Marion recommended me the Clinical Psychologist Collective when I was networking on LinkedIn, and I must say I love it. It is one of a kind. It's like a window into the lives of people on the path of becoming a psychologist. The stories are unique, honest, and filled with a kind of intangible wisdom only personal storytelling can uncover. A common thread in the stories I valued most was to be compassionate not only with others, but with myself too. Also, not fixating on becoming a psychologist, but enjoying life, grow, and the final results will come as a byproduct. Marianne, thank you for taking the time to collate all the stories. The book is a true gem, and I think every aspiring psychologist should have a copy on their shelf. Thank you.
To become a psychologist, then let this be your guide, filled with lessons and experience that will help you get qualified. So come and take a look, it's right here in this book. It's the Clinical Psychologist Collective. It's the Clinical Psychologist.
Thank you so much for listening. I really love to connect with you over on socials. LinkedIn is Dr. Marianne Trent. YouTube is Good Thinking Psychological Services. Facebook is also Good Thinking Psychological Services. Twitter is Good Thinking PS1. Instagram is Dr. Marianne Trent. If TikTok is your jam, I'm also on there too, at Dr. Marianne Trent. Being well supported during psychology application season is so important. We have got one final date planned for a compassionate Q&A, which is going to be taking place on the 9th of May, Monday the 9th of May, at 7:30 p.m. UK time. And that is free to attend. If you would like to watch any of the replays from the three previous episodes, then you can do so by going along to Good Thinking Psychological Services on YouTube. And then if you click the playlist, Compassionate Q&A, you'll be able to find the three previous episodes there. Hope you will find it useful. And as ever, we'd love any feedback you've got on any of our free resources. If you are finding this podcast helpful, please do talk about it on social media. Tag me in, tag your friends, do all of those good things. And I will look forward to catching up with you on our next episode, which will be along on Mondays at 6 a.m. UK time. Thank you so much.
If you're looking to become a psychologist, then let this be your guide. With this podcast at your side, you'll be on your way to being qualified. It's the Aspiring Psychologist Podcast with Dr. Marianne Trent.
My name's Yana, and I'm a trainee psychological wellbeing practitioner. I read the Clinical Psychologist Collective book. I found it really interesting about all the different stories and how people got to become a clinical psychologist. It just amazed me how many different routes there are to get there, and there's no perfect way to become one. And this kind of filled me with confidence that no, I'm not doing it wrong, and put less pressure on myself. So if you're feeling a bit uneasy about becoming a clinical psychologist, I'd definitely recommend this just to put yourself at ease, and everything will be okay. But trust me, you will not put the book down once you start.